Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
A new visitor tonight.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
How did you hear about us?
My friend Lou.
Oh? Lucky you. Let's do names around.
Ellie.
Jeffrey.
Wendy.
Nico.
Mark.
Marie.
Paul.
Carolyn.
Karen.
Leon.
Tomas.
Tomas. Angie. And Mark, you've been here before.
You came on Wednesday night.
That's why you're familiar. I'm glad to see you. We're working on the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is translated by Burton Watson. There are two other translations that I've been reading as well, one by Robert Thurman, which has good notes in the back, helpful notes, and the other one is a new one by Thomas Cleary. On Kindle only, so that you can't copy it. It's a very good translation and close to Thurman's, very close to Thurman's, and a little bit different from Watson, who is much earlier. and we have come to about the maybe a midpoint, it looks like, a chapter called Beyond Comprehension in this translation. The other two call it the Inconceivable Liberation, which is more accurate, I would say. It's more what the chapter is saying. Inconceivable Liberation. And the whole first part of it is the teaching of all the things you cannot say about it. Well, you cannot think about it. You cannot do about it. And that the harder you try it, the farther away you get. it starts out with a kind of jokey thing where Shariputra, who is the bodhisattva, kind of interfacing with Buddha and with Vimalakirti, says to Vimalakirti, how come there aren't any seats in this room? It's an empty room. There's no place to sit down. and said the rich man Vimalakirti, knowing what was in his mind, said to Shariputra, did you come here for the sake of the law, or are you just looking for a place to sit? Kind of rude, but very frank. And Shariputra says, right, I came for the law, not for a seat. So Vimalakirti dives right in and says, a seeker of the law doesn't concern himself even about life or limb, much less about a seat. So when he's talking about the law, he's talking about what we call maybe the truth, or sometimes we say the Dharma. It's hard to even put a name on what it is that we mean by the law. It's not a written law that the Supreme Court is interested in, but say a natural law, even though that's not it either. It's as big as Buddha and as Sangha. And it goes together with those two. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. It's how we live together, the vitality and the intensity and the connection that we all have as beings together. Shariputra, a seeker of the law, doesn't seek it through attachment to the Buddha, doesn't seek it through attachment to the law, doesn't seek it through attachment to the order, to the Sangha. He doesn't seek it through recognition of suffering, doesn't seek it through renunciation of attachments, doesn't seek it through realization of how to end attachments or through the practice of the way. Because the law has nothing to do with idle theorizing. So though there are masses and masses of objects like this which hold what we call the Dharma, he's saying that none of that is, bottom line, is relevant. Individually, in for our, by our, with our meeting with the truth, we can't take theory about it anymore. He said, tranquil extinction is not seeking the law. The law is called unstained. But if one is stained with the idea of the law or of nirvana, then one's stained with attachment. And this isn't seeking the law. So he goes through a whole long list of not picking and choosing, not pursuing a goal. Law is independent of place, but if one fixes on the idea of place, it's a fixation with place. So as soon as you begin to think it, it becomes something else. And isn't that true all day long? There's one way of being in the world, and the other way is thinking about being in the world. So interesting how we're made and how we do. Therefore, Shariputra, after this long list of seeking the law, Shariputra, if one would be a seeker of the law, one must not seek it in anything at all. So poor Shariputra. So what? But when Vimalakirti spoke these words, 500 heavenly sons gained the purity of the Dharma eye in their perception of phenomena. They saw things in a new way. Maybe they didn't see them exactly as things. Maybe looking at a beautiful flower, there's something about the beauty that is more than just a thing. At the same time, the rich man Vimalakirti said to Manjushri, who is also a part of this huge crowd in the empty room, you've visited countless thousands, 10,000 billions of unsakyas of countries. What Buddha lands have the finest and most beautiful lion seats? Those endowed with the best qualities. So, he thinks, maybe I better get some seats for these people. So Manjushri says, Layman, to the east, there's another country, far, far away. It's a land called Sumeru Shape. It's connected to the great mountain in the center of the world. The Buddha's name there, and there's a Buddha there, his name is Lamp King, and his body is huge. And the lion seat he sits on is 84,000 yoganas height and adorned in the finest fashion. So suddenly we're getting into high class stuff. The rich man Vimalakirti then exercised his transcendental powers, and at once that Buddha dispatched 32,000 lion seats, tall, broad, adorned, and pure, and had them brought to the room where the bodhisattvas, major disciples, Indras, Brahmas, four heavenly kings, and the others saw something they'd never seen before. For the room was broad and spacious enough to hold all of these 32,000 lion seeds without the slightest crowding or hindrance. So Vimalakirti said to Manjushri, "Sit down in one of the lion seats." The bodhisattvas and the other distinguished persons should also sit down, but when they do so, they should assume bodies that are suitable to the size of the seats. So get big, guys, if you want to sit with me. The bodhisattvas who had acquired transcendental powers thereupon immediately transformed their shapes, making themselves 42 yogjanas tall, and sat down in the lion seats. But among the bodhisattvas who had newly embarked on their course, or the major disciples, there were none who could climb up into the seats. When I read this, I always think, I'm one of the little guys down there looking at those seats. I never get up there. But Shariputra said, at that time, Vimalakirti said to Shariputra, "Sit down in a lion seat." And Shariputra said, "These seats are too tall and wide. We can't climb up in them." Vimalakirti said, "Ah, Shariputra, if you make obeisance to the Sumeru lamp king, then you will be able to take a seat." So the bodhisattvas who are new and the major disciples made obeisance to the king, and then they could sit in the seats in great state. Shariputra said, "I've never seen such a thing, a little room like this, and it still can hold seats as tall and broad as these." Vimalakirti said, "Shariputra, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have an emancipation that is called beyond comprehension. When a bodhisattva dwells in this emancipation, he can take something as tall and broad as Mount Sumeru and put it inside a mustard seed without enlarging one or shrinking the other." Only those destined for enlightenment will be able to see that Sumeru has been put inside a mustard seed. We have this in our English tradition. Some of our poets have spoken in this same way. It's in the Bible as well. Or again, the bodhisattva can take the waters of the four great oceans and pour them into an opening that holds a single hair, without bothering the fish and the turtles and all the others that are in there. Or the bodhisattva who dwells in emancipation beyond comprehension can slice off 1,000,000,000-fold world and grasp it in the palm of his right hand and twirl it like a potter's wheel. Or the bodhisattva can stretch time, make it long or make it short. Or he can take the magnificent adornments from all the Buddha lands and put them all together and show them to everybody. And put all the beings of a single Buddha land in the palm of his hand and fly around with them. Or the bodhisattva can take all the things offered to the Buddha by the beings in the worlds in the 10 directions and make them all visible within a pore that holds a single hair. Look inside. It's all there. Or he can go down into the lower region past Buddha lands numerous as the sands of Ganges and pick up one Buddha land and lift it up to the upper region as one would lift a leaf on the point of a needle, and that land will be in no way troubled. So there's another one about appearances. And then a bodhisattva can transcend his powers, can make himself appear to the body of a Buddha as the body of a Buddha, or the body of a Pratyeka Buddha, or that of a boy seer. He could look like just about any of those, a wheel-turning king, or he can take all the voices uttered by beings in the worlds of the 10 directions and transform them all into the voice of the Buddha. He said, I've just briefly described the powers of this bodhisattva of the emancipation beyond comprehension, but I could go on forever and never be done. So Mahakashyapa, who was Shakyamuni Buddha's chief disciple, in Zen the story of Mahakashyapa is that Buddha identified him by coming to give a talk, a Dharma talk, and everyone was gathered. And instead of speaking, he lifted a flower. And Mahakashyapa smiled. And Buddha said, "Ah, you get it. Mahakashyapa, you're my chief disciple now." So Mahakashyapa heard this and sighed at encountering what he'd never heard before. He said, we're all in this, we are all incapable of understanding it. If wise people hear it, there will be none who do not set their minds on attaining enlightenment. But what of us who are forever cut off at the root? When I first read this, I thought, what does he mean? He's the biggest guy. He's the one in the disciples. But the disciples were all what were called arhats. And their so-called accomplishment was to cut off the root of attachment and be done with everything. Still in the world, but having crossed over and given up all attachments of every kind. He said, we're forever caught off at the root. Who, with regard to these great vehicle teachings, have already become like rotten seed? When all of us hear this doctrine of emancipation beyond comprehension, we'll surely all cry out in anguish in voices loud enough to shake the whole world. But bodhisattvas should all accept this teaching with great joy and thanksgiving. For if there are bodhisattvas who put faith in this doctrine, then none of the host of devils can do anything to them. Vimalakirti said, sir, among those who play the part of devil kings in the immeasurable worlds in the 10 directions are, in fact, bodhisattvas dwelling in emancipation. Beyond comprehension, they employ their skill in expedient means to teach and convert living beings by appearing in the guise of devil kings. It's what we know from our experience that so-called evil beings are showing up all the time, and we are feeling exposed by all the things that happen in the world, and feeling that we know what they are. But of course, that kind of knowing, that kind of comprehension, is another version of what he's talking about. It's not an emancipated view. So what he's saying is that bodhisattvas who dwell in emancipation beyond comprehension employ their skill in expedient means and go to other bodhisattvas to test them and make sure that they're firm in their resolve. But some of them turn out to be bad guys. And so that's very helpful. They're bad bodhisattvas, or they're bad bodhisattvas giving one the opportunity to practice. It's a little gnarly, the argument, you could say, is a little gnarly. It ends by saying only a bodhisattva can harass another bodhisattva. The one who isn't a bodhisattva can't bother anybody. But if a bodhisattva is a bodhisattva, everything else is bodhisattva too. That's what it's pointing to, basically. If we stop labeling everything and deciding what is likable and what is not likable, what is evil and what is good, in the sense that this is talking about, it's pointless for Mahakashapa to feel that he was left out, because there is no being left out. There is no ultimate place to be except just right where we are. So gnarly as it is, it's a very helpful thing to think of. The note here says Vimalakirti probably has in mind the various tales in Buddhist lore of deities who take on devilish form and beg practitioners the way for a piece of their body as a means of testing their dedication to the paramita of almsgiving. Vimalakirti is thus suggesting that the difficulties that Mahakashapa and the other voice hearers face may in fact just be a means of testing their resolve. So they feel like they're being left out, but of course it's not like that. So what it means for us, I think, is in a practical sense that whatever we encounter is first of all an opportunity to practice in terms of being bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva can't be harassed by a bodhisattva, and a bodhisattva doesn't harass another bodhisattva. You meet on whatever terms and level you find yourself. That is one of the teachings that runs all through Zen. It's the Avalokiteshvara stance of meeting. If you meet a butcher, you meet in the realm of the butcher. If you meet an angel, you meet in the realm of the angel. And it isn't that, in a practical sense, that we don't distinguish between what is healthy and wholesome and good, between that and what is unhealthy and unwholesome and in some cases wicked, because those exist as well, but only on the most tenuous terms, because very often what we think is absolutely wrong turns the whole way around. It turns into something else entirely that is helpful and good. So the main point is not to attached to any opinion any longer than it serves the truth. And the truth is what's happening, not what we think. The truth is the experience itself, not the ideas of it, not the theories of it, but what's actually happening. But told in a very convoluted kind of way, which is beyond comprehension. It's just beyond us. So are there questions and comments?
The way is easy. It just avoids picking and choosing.
Yes.
So if something comes up in meditation that you feel is bad or wicked or somehow beneath you, that is something to deal with, not something to say that is bad, that is something I shouldn't mess with. It's just not part of the practice. Everything is a part of the practice.
Yes, exactly. So if something unsavory comes up in meditation, say, oh, look at that. Where'd that come from? Because really, we don't quite know where anything comes from in our mind. It just comes.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You remember, it's not you who's doing the practice.
You're being practiced.
You're being practiced upon.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. It is kind of a joke. Yes. Presumably.
Yeah. Of the Buddha.
But they were all transmitted, actually. They all... I mean, this is all mixed up history.
Sure.
It depends on what you're reading, what it is. Mm-hmm. In Zen, the story is that the original disciples gathered around Buddha and became enlightened. But that the Mahayana brought in this other side of things, or expressed another side of things that required more than just that practice. So the incomprehensible practice that's required beyond the arhat practice. So those guys hadn't done that according to this story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a story.
Sure.
And it's making a point, which is why they tell it this way. But we don't really know. I often wonder what it was like. Those men were, and then those women were the original disciples.
Mm-hmm.
We know a little bit. We have the women's poems. We have stories. They were all very, very well-meaning and managed to bring it to us all through the ages from the very beginning. And all those distinctions are all after the fact. Used to be when I first went into this, began to really read about it, the story was that they did it all wrong. And it was called Hinayana because it was a small raft. And those guys just didn't even know. And the Mahayana meant the large raft, and this is the best way. And that isn't what it was at all. It was just different kinds of practice all happening in the same general area. So at Nalanda University, for instance, there were many, many different kinds of practices. There were Vipassana practices, there were Vajrayana practices, there were Mahayana practices, all being taught and being done in this enormous university in ancient India. So all the distinctions that we simple-minded Westerners made when the Dharma first came to the West, and we're beginning to see, was just baby talk. And already we hardly know much more, but we do know more. And it's much more interesting and much closer to Buddha's teaching, which is that we all belong. There isn't any separate place to be or separate understanding. We all belong on the most fundamental level. There is no separation. Even though there are different ways of going about it. And as you can tell in America and in Europe, it's getting all mixed up together in wonderful ways. So Vipassana people sit Zen, and Zen people sit Vipassana, and a lot of people go the Tibetan way and get a Tibetan teacher too. So there's room for all of it. Even in this little tiny empty room, there's room for all of it. It all fits.
As long as you don't bring big chairs.
We don't need big chairs. These little Quaker chairs will be just fine.
Mahakashapa's here.
Yes, there's Mahakashapa with a sword cutting through the nonsense of the sitting mind.
The flower.
Oh, the flower. Oh, the flower, of course. That flower looks like a bride to me. So beautiful. Thank you, Jeffrey. Well, it's 8 o'clock. Are there announcements?
We should announce the sashin for people who don't know. We're having a sashin the 12th through the 19th. And it's open, so you don't have to come for the whole thing. You can come for part of it, and we flyer out and the rest of you about it. You can email the email address that's on there if you want to sign up, or just let us know you're coming, and there's a registration form online, so lots of different ways to participate.
It's beautiful up there right now. Up at Jikoji, up on the Santa Cruz Mountains, so it's very, very lovely. We'll sit for 1 minute.